The behaviorism can't die. It doesn't matter how often it's refuted and how fully it's refuted. It comes right back to life. It's right back the next day.
Can pigeons read? This one gives every indication, because he's been taught to distinguish between two words and to behave appropriately. He's learned his different response to each sign by being rewarded with food. So the bird isn't acting independently. Its behavior is shaped by controlling its environment. The first task was to isolate an individual piece of behavior and see how that could be changed. Skinner did this by keeping individual pigeons at about 3/4 of their normal weight, so that the birds were always hungry, and food could be used as an automatic reward. The pigeon was studied in a uniform box, one it quickly grew used to. One piece of behavior, pecking a colored disc, was measured on a graph. The pigeon learned that pecking the disc produced a reward. Then the behavior of pecking could be studied in relation to how often that reward was offered, or in Skinner's terms, what was the schedule of reinforcement.
The main thing is what we call schedules of reinforcement. Reinforcement is what the layman calls reward, and you can schedule it so that a reward occurs every now and then when a pigeon does something. We usually use a response with a pigeon pecking a little disc, a little spot in the wall, and you can reinforce with food. But you don't reinforce every time, perhaps every tenth time, or perhaps only once every minute or something like that. There are a very large number of schedules, and they have their special effects. And there is a good example of how you can move from the pigeon to the human case, because one of the schedules which is very effective with rats or pigeons is what we call the variable ratio schedule, and that is at the heart of all gambling devices and has the same effect. A pigeon can become a pathological gambler just as a person can. Now, the fact that we found that out with pigeons and could prove it by removing and changing the schedule makes it easy for us to interpret the case with the human subject. We don't say that the human subject gambles to punish himself, as the Freudians might say, or gambles because he feels excited when he does so. Nothing of the sort. People gamble because of the schedule of the reinforcement that follows. And this is true of all gambling systems. They all have variable ratios built into them. So what we've learned from the pigeon, it made it possible to interpret this vast field very effectively.
Where does that leave free will? Because we all think we have a choice whether to do things or not to do things.
Yes. Well, you see, it leaves it in the position of a fiction. We have assumed somehow or other that these internal states, feelings, and so on, have initiated something. They have started something. They have created. We have done something in a voluntary way. We have willed to act. If you now look at the actual history, we find that there are external reasons why this has happened. In other words, by discovering the causes of behavior, we can dispose of the imagined internal cause. We dispose of free will as an American divine of the 18th century, Jonathan Edwards, did. He said, we believe in free will because we know about our behavior, but not about its causes. And of course, it's the object of a science of behavior to discover causes. And once you have found those causes, there is less need to attribute to an internal act of will, and eventually, I think, we need to attribute nothing to it.
Thank you. But a lot of this is getting in, especially in school. It's getting in early before people have developed these background loops, these programs that they run to make their decisions for them. It seems like a lot of this is before people have developed them for themselves. Here's how we can get in, and here's how we can help develop these so that as these people grow into adults, the programming that they have is actually our programming and not their programming. A lot of this is easy to break if you just take that time to step back and observe it. Why do I always reach out with this hand to open the door? Why, when somebody comes at me this way, is my immediate response to come back at them this way? Why, when life presents this situation, do I always default to this type of action? There is a program that's going on. Where did that program come from? Why do I return to that program? And is there a program that would serve me better in the future? So the reason why they do it in the educational system is to get in there early and set that for you so that you don't set it for yourself, so that you don't consciously work this stuff out for yourself.
Absolutely. We talk about being stimulus response. Even if we understand all of this, right? Our inner world, our psychology is a cosmos filled with galactic size events happening that we might not even understand. I have blind spots to this for sure. There is a lot going on in the background. And to stop people from exploring that, from opening up the space between stimulus and response. And we stop ourselves all the time. You know, you can't blame this on some kind of technology or how the schooling system works. We're shortcutting our own thinking based on past events, based on triggers that we have. You know, it's easy to know these things and still have blind spots. Hey, it's Brett. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving Eve. Today is Wednesday, November 25th. Also, there's no judgment in this show. You heard that intro. You might have heard some of your notification sounds. You might have heard some of your Candy Crush music playing in the background under friend of the show B.F. Skinner. There's lots of reasons you might be offended at this point. You might be a pigeon for all I know. There's no judgment. We're all on the same team here. We're all susceptible to this. Nathan Frazier and I are going to talk about it today. Also, again, you're a supporting listener. You're saying, I cannot believe he put this bonus show that I signed up for out again for free. This is like 3 out of 4 times that he's done it. He is me, Brett. I'm in charge here. Well, there's a little bit of upheaval. I had to do some rescheduling last week, so there wasn't going to be a show this week if not for this. So yes, once again, Emotional Manipulators for Hire is a free podcast for all. And if you're enjoying the consumption of it currently and you do not support us, please think about doing so at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. You've recently become a millionaire because of Bitcoin, maybe temporarily. You can become a member that way. Or if you want basically instant access. Access within 5 minutes to every bonus show we've done since 2016. You can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks. Supporting listeners are going to get a lovely installment tomorrow of our University weekly discussion group. I jumped on the Discord this morning and I said, hey, everybody, today at 9:30, come and tell me what you are grateful for. Richard Grove was on the call with me. He had some really insightful things to say. I think about 10 people shared, including myself. It was definitely one of the highlights of my day today. So you'll get to hear that tomorrow on Thanksgiving. In closing here with this part, please remember, School Sucks is a listener-supported show. We do have some wonderful partners like Autonomy and Online Great Books and Crash.co. But this show is made possible by you, the listener. And it is one of the most thoroughly satisfying things I have done in my entire life. I've been doing it for more than 1/4 of my life. I love to do this. People write to me. I don't think I've ever told you this before. People write to me and they say, can I edit your podcast? And I say, no one will ever edit an episode of this podcast besides me. What would they even do? So it is a lot of work. And I love to do that work. But it needs to continue to make sense to do it. So please help us out. So today we're going to discuss behaviorism. It is a topic we have definitely covered before. You can go to schoolsucksproject.com and in the search box there, just put behaviorism. And there's at least a handful of like fairly deep explorations. But I never talked about it with Nathan Frazier from a marketing standpoint. So we do a lot of that in the conversation today. I hope you have a wonderful holiday. I hope you get to be with family and friends and loved ones. And I look forward to talking to you again next week. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Let's take a walk with no point, no purpose. Just get outside and go around the block. I'm kind of bored and so are you. Let's go kill an hour or two. Just take a walk. With no point, no purpose. Oh yeah. Cause I got nothing on my mind. I wonder what I might find. My shoes are the only sound roaming around.
Hey Nathan, welcome back.
I am excited to be on the air for this one, man.
Yeah, so we're going to be treading over some familiar ground as far as School Sucks content is concerned, but I'm really excited to hear your input on this one as to how it could be used for good. I don't believe it at the beginning of the show because this is some nasty stuff, behaviorism. I thought I would let you actually introduce it. I wanted to hear your perspective on it. You know, I was going through Evernote when we were talking about doing this topic, and I was like, man, I've got too many notes on behaviorism. Classical conditioning, operant conditioning. We've done at least a handful of shows about this. And it comes up anytime you're talking about the way public schooling works, because it basically is the operating psychological framework as it applies to the schools. We can take that pretty far. John Taylor Gatto actually covered this in a lot of his work too, that in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, there was a thorough project to really reform the schools in the behaviorist model. And we can get into that in a little bit of detail. It will be treading over some familiar ground, like I said, for my audience, but I'm happy to do it. I'd love to hear a little bit about your prior knowledge of behaviorism and how you think it applies to our larger project here.
I've always been I don't want to say a fan of this stuff, but this is the type of stuff that actually led me to get into marketing in the first place because I'm kind of a conspiracy theorist, I guess. And because I am somebody who kind of geeks out on human psychology. And I noticed a lot of this stuff was used on us very early on. I think we'll probably run the gamut of all the different areas in society that it's used. But I first noticed it in school. Then I started noticing it in the news. I started noticing it in video games. I started noticing it in even interactions between parents and children. We subconsciously pass a lot of this stuff on to our children. And my 30-second elevator pitch for it is people can be programmed just like computers. People can be programmed just like dogs can be trained.
Right.
And it sounds like a crazy conspiracy theorist, but then when you look into the research that has gone into it and the results that that research has yielded, it's pretty conclusive. We are easily programmable beings. And the disclaimer that I always like to start these conversations with is, I don't like that humans are this way. I spend a lot of my time trying to make people aware that we're this way so that they don't fall victim to it. But I also am paid to live in the world of what is rather than the world of what I wish was.
Yeah.
And as a marketer, I do employ some of these tactics in my marketing, and I'm not going to try and justify it, but I am going to be honest about it. We are going to talk about how some of this stuff can be used in marketing. I guess that's my introduction into why I wanted to have this conversation with you.
This is one of the reasons why you inspire me, actually, because I live in a world of what it is not. It's interesting. I am nervous as to whether or not you were going to reference anything that is actually happening in the bigger world or that people are talking about on social media. I have been checked out for 5 solid days. I'm just doing an experiment. I haven't looked at news. I haven't been on Facebook. I haven't been on Twitter. Not that I go on Twitter or Instagram or any of these places. So I've been sitting here for the last 5 days saying, how can I put more kindness into this cruel world? I really have been doing this. I live in basically fantasy land at this point, considering what's going on behind or beyond these walls. So I like to check in with you to remind myself that my fantasy land is also a business, and I need to be aware of how human beings actually behave in the real world. And, you know, I don't want to sell myself short. A lot of our work is about trying to understand how and why human beings behave that way too, and to remember it for ourselves. But geez, you're right. I mean, behaviorism just explains so much, or it's so visible in our society. And I will go back to one of the reasons for that is it is just so prevalent in the schools. And I would basically describe it as a psychology that ignores the inner life, right? The inner life that is responsible for so much of our conscious thinking, so much of our physical doing, and so many of the consequences that result from those things. But all of that has been made invisible by, I'm going to use a strong conspiratorial word here, programming people using behaviorist concepts. Behaviorism almost entirely disregards human emotion. It does not recognize, and this is something that I debate with myself all the time, but in behaviorism, there is no free will, right? The idea is basically the mind is a blank slate, and all of our behaviors can be developed or redeveloped through some form of conditioning.
If I'm not mistaken, I think it was B.F. Skinner that said, give me a child at a specific age, and I can turn them into whatever I want them to be, a nurse, a police officer, a teacher, whatever. He was that certain in his understanding of this stuff that he felt he could take any child and turn them into anything he wanted.
I think every psycho says that.
Yeah.
I think Lenin said that. I think Hitler said that. I think if you're a psycho, at some point you just realize, you know, shit, if I could just control people from the time they were a little kid, I could just get them to do whatever I want.
So let's kind of dive into this a little bit. And
sure.
I'd like to get your take, the difference between, because there's kind of two schools of thought here. There's classical conditioning and then there's operant conditioning. And from your understanding, I'd like to kind of see if we're on the same page as to what the two are.
Sure. So operant conditioning involves like having consequences that lead to changes in behavior. It's more cause and effect, while classical conditioning is more like stimulus response without a thinking process involved. I mean, the way behaviorism breaks out is four forms. There's reinforcements and punishment. So there is a positive reinforcement, which is, you know, good job, here's a sticker. A positive punishment, which is an added burden. So you're getting something in the positive reinforcement, the positive punishment, something is being delivered as a result of a behavior. But then on the flip, there's also negative reinforcement. You did a bad job. Esteem is being taken away from somebody, or negative punishment, which is like a lost privilege, right? And just think about the script for life that can create for people. I mean, that's entirely, we just covered basically all the rules of school and the functioning of school through that. You know, if people get sucked into this and they never make it explicit, they never realize it's happening, these are people who, you know, even if it's only applied in certain places. So like the challenge that we're dealing with now is like social media. Recently, there was a lot of talk, and I think we'll get into this in more detail, video games. People are new-ish to these kinds of technologies. So the behaviorism applied to them is more invisible, and thus people are more susceptible to it. All four of those functions of behaviorism.
So the way I kind of think about it, and correct me if I'm wrong, classical conditioning, I kind of see it as a more of a subconscious. It's where they take something that you don't like and associate it with something they don't want you to do so that you subconsciously stop doing the thing that they don't want you to do. You associate it subconsciously as being bad, whereas operant conditioning is more of the carrot and stick type of conditioning. Mm-hmm. It's more of the, if you do this, you know that the results are going to be this, so it's best not to do this.
Yeah, just to put Pavlov and Skinner, that are the two big names that people have heard of, into, you know, each of these categories. Pavlov is classical conditioning, unconditioned stimulus. Somebody rings a bell and feeds a dog, let's say, and the dog then comes to associate the sound of the bell with food. So we'll start to salivate. That was Pavlov's project, and that probably started, 130 years ago. We've been dealing with these people. Operant conditioning with Skinner came later in the mid-20th century. And yeah, you're right. It's more of a conscious process that, you know, there's a cause and effect to behavior, but it's still a form of conditioning. So I think operant conditioning, well, I would say they're equally dangerous because both are able to shape what, especially operant conditioning, but it's tricky because classical can be used in this as well, to shape through behind-the-scenes forces what seems like voluntary behavior, while getting people to basically internalize the domination systems that are inflicting this behaviorism on them. So we both encountered Thaddeus Russell in our lives, and he talked about this idea of, you know, the internal policeman, right? The internal judge, shame, all of these things kind of play into that. So one of the goals of behaviorism is to put that policeman in the head of the person, government going into the mind and being internalized without a person ever consciously realizing it. And thus, it is very difficult for them to imagine a different way of thinking, which is why you and I are considered insane.
So I've talked with Landon Porter, who was a recent guest on your show.
Love that guy.
Yes. Yeah. So we've talked, me and him have had conversations about how most of what we do on a daily basis, 99% of it is just unconscious. We're not thinking about how far we're going to take on each step. We're not thinking about how fast we're walking. We're not thinking about which hand we reach out to open a door with. We're not thinking about most of our responses. Most of that stuff is on like a program in the background that's running, our heartbeat, our breathing, most of our menial tasks. It's all on a background.
Yeah.
It's all on a program. And then there's certain things that we consciously think through. And we do this as human beings. We do this because we have to conserve energy. Thinking about stuff requires energy. It requires mental energy. We want to reserve it for the important decisions. We don't want to waste our cognitive energy on the menial tasks. And so we have a bunch of stuff that we set off to. These are the things that run on the loop on the program. And then these are the things that I actually give conscious awareness to, thought to. What a lot of this is getting in, especially it seems like in school, it's getting in early before people have developed these background loops, these programs that they run in the background to make their decisions for them. It seems like a lot of this is before people have developed them for themselves. Here's how we can get in, and here's how we can help develop these so that as these people grow into adults, the programming that they have is actually our programming and not their programming. And one of the things that Landon talks about, and me and him have had conversations about, is a lot of this is easy to break if you just take that time to step back and observe it and say, why do I do this when I do this? Why do I always reach out with this hand to open the door? Why, when somebody comes at me this way, is my immediate response to come back at them this way? Why, when life presents this situation, do I always default to this type of action? And just stopping and saying, there is a program that's going on. Where did that program come from? Why do I return to that program? And is there a program that would serve me better in the future? So a lot of this stuff is, in my opinion, a lot of this stuff is the reason why they do it in the educational system is to get in there early and set that for you so that you don't set it for yourself, so that you don't consciously work this stuff out for yourself.
Absolutely. We talk about being stimulus response, and even if we understand all of this, right, our inner world, our psychology is a cosmos filled with galactic size events happening that we might not even understand. And I'm susceptible to this. I have blind spots to this for sure. There is a lot going on in the background. And to stop people from exploring that, from opening up the space between stimulus and response. And we stop ourselves all the time. You know, you can't blame this on some kind of technology or how the schooling system works. We're shortcutting our own thinking based on past events, based on triggers that we have. You know, it's easy to know these things and still have blind spots.
So you mentioned Pavlov. Mm. Maybe I did, but you kind of went off on a tangent about him.
This show could be 4 hours. I've got so many tangents and quotes about all these people who set up the school system and the stuff. I do want to go through some of John Taylor Gatto's notes about how the behaviorist incursion happened in public school in the 60s and 70s. But I could read you just terrifying quotes from these people saying behaviorist things before Skinner even did his work. But it's like when Skinner is applied to it, that's when it really takes off. But yes, I'm sorry.
I know that when I first started falling down this rabbit hole, it was there was like a hidden history of the education system or something that our mutual friend Richard was part of putting together. It was like a 8.5 hour long series that really dived deep into this, and it was based off of most of Gatto's life work.
Sure. So Rich made a documentary called The Ultimate History Lesson, I think about 9 years ago. And I made a video series just called The Underground History of American Education that was actually one of the functions of that was to basically amplify Gatto to a YouTube audience, but also promote Rich's film. And a lot of the content that Rich discussed with John Taylor Gatto in The Ultimate History Lesson came from a book called The Underground History of American Education that Gatto wrote, I think, about 20 years ago. Oh, I got a great Gatto story, too. But Gatto writes this book where he just horrifies you with all of these stories going back, as far as school is concerned, to the early 1800s and the designs of people who wanted to scientifically manage their populations that were applied to those populations throughout that time from Central Europe and how it came into the United States and progressed from there. Then he hits you with, I think it's like 1967 is the starting point, I remember. And the last one of these was like in the mid 70s, where they revamped the entire teacher training programs for the public schools. And this was a combined work of like private foundations, academia, corporations, think tanks, government agencies, coordinated through what at the time was called the U.S. Office of Education. There was no Department of Education then. So there was one called Designing Education for the Future. There was another one called the Behavior Science Teacher Education Project, and there was another one called Bloom's Taxonomy of Educational Objectives. I actually have notes on some of the things that Gatto said here. He describes the first one, Designing Education for the Future, as laying out education as a means to achieve economic and social goals of a national character. And again, this is through Gatto's lens, but it was promoting the loss of individual independence in order to have people identify with their school, with their larger collective, but then even scale that to the schools and the districts, basically have a partnership with the federal government. So to have everything directed from the top down made it easy. It's kind of like communism, right? Where it only works if everybody behaves. And that's why these societies are so totalitarian, is it only works if people behave how they're supposed to behave, because they're all just beings being counted. But understanding the liability and the inconvenience of individual identity at every step in that process, all the way up to the people who are directing it from the top, was one of the things that was put forward as that loss of independence as a desired goal in this first one of these documents that affected teacher training. The second one, it's where chemical experimentation to modify behavior was introduced. Again, this was late 1960s. The taxonomy of educational objectives was really about classifying people. So if you've ever heard of outcomes-based education, that came along and was kind of exposed by a group of conservatives in Pennsylvania in the 1980s, this was really, they called it remediation. So they would test people on attitudes and values. And if people had troublesome attitudes and values, they would be remediated to feel differently. So if you have improper thoughts, and those improper thoughts lead to improper, you know, beliefs, outcomes, or actions, desires, they needed to be remediated. So that was outcomes-based education. So that was what was inserted into an already anti-individual, anti-creativity, anti-critical thinking, anti-independent system in the United States in the 1960s and 70s.
So when I was doing research for this particular episode, one of the things that I kept coming across was when I was looking up videos and when I was looking up research on behavioralism, written from an educator's point of view, they kept calling behaviorism a learning tool. They didn't refer to it as some kind of nefarious way to brainwash children or control children and condition them. They just kept saying, hey, this is the best way to teach. If you're a teacher and you're running into these issues, here's a really great tool for helping educate. And so you actually spent a lot of time in the education system.
Yeah.
I want to get your thoughts on that particular understanding of it.
Sure. I mean, we are hitting this from kind of a conspiratorial angle, but I think it's fair to say that most learning environments are an integration of three or four primary learning theories. So behaviorism, at least as far as school is concerned, is probably the most prominent. And as far as a teaching and learning tool, you could say that there are some positive things in having measurable, predefined goals. We certainly agree with that from the standpoint of productivity or being entrepreneurs. Having goals that are measurable to some extent are probably pretty important to how we manage our time. And if you are, you know, I mean, so you do have a management piece and a control piece that comes into it. But in our own learning, there's a kind of efficiency to that. So it's not all, I mean, when it's invisible and when it's used to program and make people programmable and reprogrammable without ever noticing what is happening to them, it is certainly nefarious, but it is not, I would say, by itself necessarily like evil. Another common theory that is often used with is called cognitivism. So like some school uses cognitivism, some college, the trivium method that we've both probably talked about. I'd say the idea is if we understand learning, we're more likely to find meaning and consistency when we search for new knowledge and align it with previous knowledge. So it's like becoming aware of our own thinking. Cognitivism is meaning making. So it's an invitation beyond what behaviorism is to, I would say, invite the so-called learner, because there are aspects of behaviorism that, to use the word learning over programming or conditioning, that would be debatable. But cognitivism kind of invites the learner into the examination of the learner process, I think in a way that behaviorism just doesn't do. And the third one is constructivism, which is something that we probably spent a lot of time promoting on my show. And constructivism would be most prevalent in places like Sudbury School, but some of the worst features of it are becoming apparent in regular school. Sudbury first. This is very much hands-off, student-centered, pursue your passions, teach yourself, make meaning for yourself, which can be a good thing if you're talking about building a picture of meaning of your own life. But one of the things that we've started to see in school, and this is true in college too, people can just believe whatever they want, and it's oppressive if you don't think they're right about it. So constructivism honors, I would say, the importance of social influences in learning and tries to respect free will. So now it is almost in opposition entirely to what behaviorism is.
So I want to take it back to behaviorism, and we'll talk about a couple of the kind of founding fathers of it. Pavlov, you mentioned, I think the story that I heard about his experiments was he discovered that every time he went to go feed his dogs, they would salivate. And so he wanted to see if he could force his dogs or cause his dogs to salivate without the food. So what he would do is every time he would feed them, first he would ring a bell, then he would feed them. His theory was that the bell ringing would get the dogs to associate. By ringing the bell and feeding them, they would associate the bell ringing with the food. Mm-hmm. And eventually he would be able to just ring the bell, and just the bell ringing would cause them to salivate without the food. And I'm pretty sure that was kind of the conclusion that he came to. But I also read something about, and I don't know if this was Pavlov, if this was just conspiracy theory, but something about, and this is a little bit more harsh for the listeners, but they would do not just feeding dogs, but sometimes they would ring the bell and also beat the dogs, and the dogs wouldn't know which to associate the bell ringing with, and it would cause the dogs just to mentally shut down. There is a real world implication to that where I see a lot of times, just personally, I know if I walk into my house and the mail needs to be sorted, the clothes need to be folded, the dishes need to be done, dusting needs to happen, vacuuming needs to happen, I'm bombarded with an overload of sensory stimulus, my usual go-to is I'm just going to go PlayStation for a while. I'm not going to deal with all of this stuff. And another example of this would be the news. A lot of times when we're watching the news, we've got an attractive person talking to us about something horrific happening. And we've got the news ticker on the bottom telling us the latest horrors that are going on in the world. We've got the one right underneath that telling us about how our stocks are doing. And we're having eight different sensory pieces of information just bombard us every time we turn on the news, that a lot of times it causes people to go into this shutdown mode. And a lot of times when people do that, they just say, hey, I'm not going to make a decision. I'm not going to even think. I'm just going to wait for somebody to tell me what I should feel about this stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's so true. It's like it produces a kind of decision fatigue. Where, you know, this is one of the features, or the, I guess, the consequences of 24-hour news, you know, the way people engage with information on social media or YouTube or you know, anywhere else that's using this kind of like positive reinforcements, you know, hit refresh and it's all new stuff. And we keep doing it to ourselves. But yeah, the people are suffering from a real kind of information overload. And I think the impact neurologically of this is understood through that example that you gave of coming home and just encountering clutter everywhere, right? Because now the fatigue is going to come from this competition for your attention, right? You know, when we started talking about getting things done, David Allen's productivity method, and there's a book, and if people feel disorganized and overwhelmed with you know, things in their own environment, work or otherwise, it would be a really good read. We did a series on it too called Presence and Productivity, and that would be a really good listen. But clutter in your surroundings competes for your attention. It wears you down. It fatigues you. So now we see in social media and through the way cable news presents information, Matt Taibbi talks about this in his book, Hate Incorporated. It's such a goddamn bombardment of stuff that in the end, lots of people are just reduced to, okay, well, now tell me how to feel about it. It almost produces a kind of, I would say, nihilism, and makes people shy away from their own meaning-making or their own willingness to integrate multiple perspectives of what's actually going on. So we see the result as far as like polarization and tribalization, like we've talked about in earlier shows, which has many other factors. But people's inability to like process things effectively, right? That clutter, it makes you less efficient. It makes you procrastinate. And most importantly, as far as like what we're talking about here, it leads to a kind of resignation, right? People don't want that ownership over their own minds because their mind is a fucking disaster. Because mm-hmm. they let these systems that they think are rewarding them overwhelm their minds with, I don't even want to call it, sometimes they call it information overload. And we corrected this on the show a couple years ago to call it input overload, because a lot of it isn't even information, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a real problem. And having a methodology, whether you're talking about things you need to do for work, and I've waxed and waned with this a lot. I've actually gotten away from it in the last couple months, and the results have not been great. But having a place where you can take in information, you know, in a systematic way, so then you know what to do with it, right? Mm. So you are actually creating a kind of filter, creating a kind of barrier. And as things come in, you accept them, right? You acknowledge, yes, here's a thing. Yes, please, I'm ready for a thing. It's kind of like David Allen, and I think he took this from Bruce Lee, calls it mind like water. Something hits water, and yeah, it makes a splash, but eventually the water returns to a kind of equilibrium, right? Mm-hmm. Things hit us, and if we're not ready or we don't have a system to accept them, and this really relates to like productivity and time management, we are not able
to return to that equilibrium too often if like an unscheduled thing comes our way. So I would say that if people are familiar with the GTD system and they use it for, you know, time management and productivity and really presence, like really being able to like live and be in the present moment because you're not worried about what's coming or you're not distracted by something that isn't most important, to engage in that way is a really, really important thing to learn in environments that you can control. And then maybe you stand a better chance of figuring out how to use them for self-defensive purposes in these environments that you have no control over, like social media or the 24-hour news cycle. But just, you know, understanding what your capacity for intake is. It's a question that I ask people a lot when they're throwing information at me, and you can find, and sometimes I just ask myself on their behalf if they're like, you know, on YouTube or something, what can I do with this? Why do I need this? You know,
yeah.
It's messy for us too, because we're media creators. So we can trick ourselves into thinking that everything that we take in is like useful shit, but it's not true. I have turned around and created useful content out of probably 5% of the information I've taken in. And I don't know how it is for you. You're better at it. You're shaking your head no, but you are more purposeful. Your projects are more directed. They're more niche down than the School Sucks project is. So I could see you taking in information more efficiently and more strategically than I do. But I also know that you are in tune with what's going on out there. So yeah, you probably get a lot of news you can't use.
Yeah. The main point that I would want to say is when we have all of this information, we've got 15 different YouTube videos screaming at us before we finished our coffee. We've got the news tickers. We've got the 80 different Facebook stories or Twitter stories as we scroll through our feed. For a lot of people, we've got the conflicting information. We've got this president won, actually this president won, actually this president cheated, actually this president cheated. We've got these are the numbers. No, actually these are the numbers. A lot of time what that leads to is the, you know what, I can't figure out the truth from all of this. So I'm just going to trust the experts. And we fall into the what is becoming more and more popular now, a trust the expert society, a dictatorship by the experts. I think we're inching very close to that.
Yeah.
Another one that I wanted to talk about, another kind of founding father of this is John B. Watson. Are you familiar with him and his experiments?
Yeah, this is where it gets even weirder.
Yeah. So little Albert, I call him the rat boy. Do you know about that?
Yeah.
So apparently there was, I think he took an 11-month-old infant and he wanted to train this infant to be terrified of rats. So he had a pet rat, and every time he showed the boy the rat, he would also make a bunch of noise. I think he had some cymbals.
Yep. He would bang cymbals. Yeah.
And he just, every time the boy was introduced to the rat, he would just make as much clatter and noise as possible, driving the child to tears every single time. And then it got to the point where he no longer had to do the symbols. He could just show the kid a picture of a rat, and the kid would start freaking out and go into almost a comatose fear state. And it was kind of like Pavlov's dogs. It proved that, yes, it works with dogs, but it also works with people. You can take something that wouldn't cause this reaction, but if you can subconsciously link it with something that does cause that reaction, then just showing them the thing that they normally wouldn't respond this way to will cause that reaction.
Yeah. And I think it got even worse than that. I think it was having that response to things that looked like rats, mm-hmm. or, you know, just resembled rats in the slightest, you know, like something that was white and like a sock.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the age thing is interesting, and it kind of takes us back to school, because the less wisdom that a person has, the less ability they possess to be able to put a space to think and process between a stimulus and a response, right? Or this is really like stimulus react, right? Response sounds thoughtful. It means there was some processing that happened in a space before that stimulus showed up. So when people are younger and they lack these resources, this type of programming, as little Albert shows, is more effective. And I would say in this case, you know, this is definitely not a comedy. I'm even sorry for laughing at it, because this dude had to live a life after this. And I hope that went okay for him. But you take somebody, you said he was an infant, right? He was less than a year old, mm-hmm. and you apply this kind of conditioning and it sticks. It sticks. That's a very difficult kind of trauma to process.
Yeah. So what that kind of leads us to is the question that is kind of hot right now, which is nature versus nurture. Mm-hmm. Where do we get our personalities from? Where do we get our decisions from? Where do we get our choices from? These guys make a really good argument that nurture has a lot of power over where your mind goes or where your decision-making capabilities go. Right now in the gender studies area, we have arguments about, do girls play with Barbies because that's natural, or do they play with them because they're programmed to? Do boys go into STEM because they're programmed to, or because it comes easier for boys? I think that I don't think it's an either or. I don't think it's nature versus nurture. I think there's aspects on both sides of it. Mm. Because they've done studies with both humans and chimpanzees, boys tend to be attracted to things. Girls tend to be attracted to people. Boys tend to be attracted to mechanical toys. Girls tend to be attracted to toys with faces. Even before any kind of like societal programming can go on. If you look at boys' action figures, one thing people in the toy industry talk about is the hair model, the playability. Boys' toys, their hair is usually molded. It's part of the action figure, whereas girls' toys, the hair is flowing and they can actually comb it because of the different play styles. So a Barbie's hair is going to be one way, and a female action figure's hair is not going to be the same kind of like flowing hair. Because boys don't care about playing with the hair. They just want a princess to rescue, and girls want to do the hair. But then there's also things like pink and blue. Pink used to be a color for boys, and blue used to be a color for girls. And that comes from marketing style guides. Back in the day, all children would wear white because it was easy. It was the easiest to clean, and they didn't have cheap and inexpensive dyes for clothing. So
wait a minute. Why was white the easiest to clean?
Because you could soap the heck out of it without losing the color.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could just bleach everything. Yes, that makes total. I'm like, white would be filthy immediately.
No, yeah. Yeah, so, and the thing was, if you had a baby girl, and then she turned two, and then you had another kid, and it was a baby boy, you could just pass down the clothes, because they could wear the same clothes as an infant. But clothing manufacturers were like, hey, we could double our sales if we made some clothes for boys and some clothes for girls.
Yeah.
So it was from the marketing style guides. They said, hey, boys should wear pink and girls should wear blue. And then there was a switch somewhere along the lines. I'm not sure what caused the switch, but they eventually decided, actually, girls should wear blue and girls should wear pink, boys should wear blue. There's certain things like that where it's like, I don't know if pink and blue are just naturally attracted. I think most people are just naturally attracted to blue. Even girls are more attracted to blue. Hmm. How much of the things that the decisions that we make just come down to genetics, because evolution said, hey, boys who throw things like footballs and spears tend to live longer than boys who don't. And girls who are nurturing tend to create more human beings, so the species is able to perpetuate. How much of it is nurture versus how much of it is nature? And these guys make a good argument that there is a nurture aspect to it, even though people like me, I kind of push back, because I also see that there's a lot of nature in it. And that's kind of a taboo thing. You're not allowed to say there's a biological difference between boys and girls.
Over the whole scale of human history, the argument would go, a dude who knows how to throw a spear would live longer than a dude who prefers to play with a girl's hair.
Yeah.
Right.
Basically.
Yeah, you're right. Behaviorism is definitely a good argument for the nurture aspect. Considering how successful behaviorism was almost over the course of 100 years now. And I would say even before it was defined, it was used, it was understood and used in other forms, especially in the schools. But yeah, it definitely shows that if anybody comes down on the side that it's all nature, that just seems preposterous. Yeah, for what we've witnessed in the 20th century alone.
So B.F. Skinner, I would say he's not quite as villainous as the other two people that we've mentioned, because from what I've read of his experiments, they didn't make my skin crawl as much as the other two guys. Also, interesting side note, I think the principal on The Simpsons was actually named after B.F. Skinner, Principal Skinner on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that one, but he was more of a fan of operant conditioning. And he had something called the Skinner box. I don't know how familiar you are with his experiments. Like I said, to me, they don't seem as nefarious, but a little bit still on the darker side of human conditioning. So if you want, I'd like to get your take on his work.
One of those Gatto videos that I made, it's reading these quotes about how school works. And the video, the B-roll, is like a Skinner box being built. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of parallels back to those four kinds of conditioning that we talked about, basically explaining all the rules of school. So the Skinner box had a way to get a reward, then it had a way to get a punishment, essentially. So it was a construction that you could fit a rat or a pigeon in, and there was a button that they could push. And or maybe there were two buttons. One would give you food, and one would give you a shock. The whatever the animal was stood basically on an electrified grid. So that's basically how it worked. It learned that it could do a thing and get a reward, or do another thing and get a punishment.
And I think that the application of this in the real world, I see a lot in social media. I see a lot in a lot of times in social media, the algorithms are gamed or rigged to reward certain things. And I think even just recently, Facebook came out and said that they're trying to de-radicalize people. So they're trying to dissuade you from publishing certain type of content and reinforce. And they use the algorithms. They say, is this something that's going to help calm people down? Okay, cool. Push it into more feeds, and it'll get more likes, and the people will get the reward that they're looking for. And so they'll be subconsciously programmed to put more of this out. Is this something that's going to enrage people and radicalize people? Okay, cool. Let's not let this get shown to so many people. Let's not let it get as many likes. Let's make them feel like when they post this stuff, there's not as big of a reward for it. So hopefully they won't publish this stuff as much. And Facebook has come out and admitted that in the past they've done different experiments where they filter what goes into your timeline, and they say if we feed you more of this, it has this type of an impact, and you start posting more stuff like this. So if we feed you more happy things, you're generally more happy and you post more happy things. When we feed you more negative things. So this type of stuff is very prevalent in social media. Your thoughts on that, and then maybe other areas in life where we can see kind of evidence of what Skinner and the Skinner box experiments kind of play out in our everyday lives.
Sure. I just want to clarify what you said. So this, or ask you for clarification, actually, this is not the way these platforms operate. This was just an experiment they tried to see if they could basically reinforce more positive types of posts.
It was about 3 or 4 years ago, I think it was 2016 or 2017, where Facebook came out and said, hey, they admitted that they had been doing this thing where they said certain parts of the population, they algorithmically filtered what type of stuff showed up in their newsfeed. And they would, for 2 or 3 days, they would only show them negative stories. And then they would see, does this impact the type of stuff that people are posting? Does it impact their attitude? Does it impact the way that they're interacting with people, versus let's only show them positive stories and let's see how that impacts. That was 3 or 4 years ago. This new thing that I was talking about just was announced either yesterday or today as we're recording, that in the wind down after the election, Facebook has taken a proactive role in, I don't want to say deplatforming, but giving certain types of posts less traction and giving other types of posts more traction. And the main thing was, is this going to cause further radicalization? If yes, we're not going to show it to as many people so that it doesn't get as many likes and comments. And if no, then we're going to show it to more people. So as a way to, they were saying they wanted to de-radicalize, de-escalate things after the election, because they didn't want people going batshit crazy, which we have a tendency to do, especially after political events like that.
Yeah, how could they think they'd stop people from going batshit crazy now? Like, that's just a lever you can, that's like a dial you can turn down at this point.
I think that for a large percentage of the population, it is a dial that they can amp up and...
Yeah, you know, now that you say it that way, I think you're right. It will be an interesting thing now that we know that this is happening to see how it actually works. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that B.F. Skinner talked about, he talked about reinforcement schedules. And I don't know if you're familiar with this, but he talked about response rates and extinction rates. And when something would be on a schedule, when something would be, if it was every once in a while you got a shock from this thing, then the response rate would be not as high as if every single time you got a shock from the thing, or every once in a while when you push the button, some food came out versus every time you push the button. Different types of things, the carrot and stick. If every time you do this, you get a carrot, every time you do it, you get a stick, versus every five times you do it, you get a carrot, every five times you do it, you get a stick.
Yeah.
The different reinforcement schedules that you would apply to the feeding of the positive or the negative feedback, it would affect the response rates, and it would affect the extinction rate, which was how long will the condition last? So how quickly will they do what we want them to do? And how long will they continue to do what we want them to do after the stimulation has hit them? They did a lot of studies into all of this stuff. One example that I know of, and this is from working in the video game industry for a couple of years back in the 2010-ish era, casinos.
Yes.
They have, well, I'll let you give your two cents on it.
Well, the saddest place I ever saw in my life was a room that I feel like was the size of about a football field in Reno, Nevada, and it was just filled with slot machines. And people would sit there with their face, just these miserable looking faces. So like, how long will they keep going? Just mm-hmm. even knowing that the reward is there, even if they've never received it. They've just mm-hmm. heard that this is where the reward comes from in some of these cases. They will sit there and they will pull and they will pull and they will pull, and they're not even enjoying it. They're just addicted to it. And I think this shows up in addiction, right? Where the longer you maintain an active addiction, the more diminishing your returns are as far as the payoff, which is one of the reasons why people overdose or drink themselves to death, is they have to keep doing more and more to get the same effect. It's a property, I would say, of abusive, manipulative relationships, intermittent reinforcement, where, you know, a woman, I guess it could be a man too, would say, well, sometimes, once in a while, he does the sweetest things, right? But most of the time, he's an asshole, right? So just giving the person, it's a tool of control, if you were talking about people, to occasionally give them what they want. It's almost more addicting in the way when you deprive them of it. So all of these things work on these intermittent reinforcement schedules that become more efficient for the person using this as a behavioral control tactic, because they can deliver less and less, you know? I mean, alcohol or heroin doesn't have a consciousness that does this, but it works that way too. But it's super efficient, whether you're a casino or you're an abusive boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, you can use intermittent reinforcement in that way. I mean, do you see an analog there to like social media intermittent reinforcement?
I do. I don't think it's quite as strong there, just because social media, your dopamine drip does kind of rely on how engaging your content is. Mm-hmm. So Facebook can't completely control that. How often you get likes, how often you get shares, how often you get comments and stuff like that. But I think where it shows up more often, the casino example, they've worked this down to a science. They know how often do they have to have one of the 15 slot machines in a row, how often do they have to have one of them pay out in order to keep people pulling those levers? And they've got it down to a science. If we give $40 for every $100, it keeps people pulling the handle. But if we go to 39, people will get up and leave. If we go to 41, we're losing that extra dollar. Regular like handheld video games, this is something that's kind of a controversy in the video game atmosphere right now. They know, how long do we have to keep people at level 39 before they just give up and stop playing for the day? How often do we need to allow them to get to level 40, to get to level 41 in order to keep them playing? If they play for 39 minutes, will they give up? Do most people give up at the 39 minute mark? Okay, at 38 minutes, let's level them up so that they end up playing again. How often do we need to have, like on Candy Crush, how often do we need to have a screen exploding event where it eliminates all of the candies on the screen so it gives them a sense of accomplishment so they keep playing? All of these things, these companies have spent thousands and thousands of hours and dollars researching. What's the breaking point? At what minute do people stop engaging? And then a minute before that, let's give them a reward so they reinvest in spending their time with us. Facebook does this. YouTube does this. Guaranteed all of the really popular video games do this. Animal Crossing, Candy Crush, all of these little pocket video games. Also, businesses do this. Yeah. We do this with things like punch cards. How many coffees does somebody have to buy before we give them give them one for free in order to make them choose us versus the coffee shop right down the block? There's a lot of badges. You're on Audible. Oh, I just got my 10th book badge, or I just got my I've listened to 100 hours in the last 4 weeks badge, or I've got my giant library badge. Badges are another way to keep people consuming your content, keep people spending their attention and their time with you. It's called gamification marketing, and I don't know how I feel about it. It works. It's very much based on behaviorism. And I feel like it's kind of like scraping the bottom of the barrel marketing. It's the lowest hanging fruit marketing. So I'm not a big fan of it, but it does work. And a lot of it comes from these guys, John Watson, B.F. Skinner, Pavlov. A lot of what they found is now being used in the gamification of marketing.
Absolutely. I mean, there's other business examples, too, that people would probably never think of that are, as far as how they work, they are behaviorist, right? So if you think about chain restaurants, and what's in play here is like punishments and rewards. Like, what are the punishments of going out to eat? But if we just kind of loosen the definitions of these things a little bit, they make sense. And also, affecting people's behavior up to the point, but not beyond the point, where they'll notice and be like, hey, what's going on here? So chain restaurants, to move the maximum number of people in, have them have a good time, and then leave at the right time so new people can come in. Everything is a calculation. How hard should the seating be? What should the temperature of the restaurant be? All of these things are taken into consideration to try and find that average of like a person will come in a predictable average. The person will come in, they'll behave this way, and then they'll move on. You know, so it's in a lot of places where people, I think, would it's easy to see, right, on Facebook or Pornhub or school, but it's harder to see in places like that, but it is there.
Also, colors. A lot of times if you go into movie theaters, they'll have the same color of drapery on the walls. It's usually like a orange or a burgundy color because those colors will make you hungry. Temperatures, they adjust there as well. So yeah, and I really like the example that you gave about the seats. How long will somebody sit in this seat? Will they sit 15 minutes? Will they sit 25 minutes? If they're sitting 25 minutes, that means that we can't keep people coming into the restaurant. So we need to figure out that perfect comfortability level where at 15 minutes, they're like, okay, I'm done sitting here. Let's get up and go.
Yep.
Yeah, it's everywhere around us. And again, I don't know if I'm against that. If I run a business, I want to make sure that I'm having as many people in and out of the business as I possibly can. And if there's something that I can do as subtle as changing the cover on the seat to make it to where people want to leave after 15 minutes without consciously knowing that I'm trying to get them out of there, I don't know if I'm against that.
It's just good business in that case. You know, it's not like if you're not trying to make somebody an addict or a dependent. And again, it goes back to, you know, a viable learning theory in some context, especially when it's integrated with other learning theories like we talked about. So to say that it's all bad, that anybody using it would be a bad actor, certainly isn't the case. Is there a way, this is the big question, to use it for, as we say around here, for good?
So I think there's a lot of ways to use it for good, but again, some of these, they kind of walk the line. They're in the gray area. Real quick, one last example that I want to give that you just brought up,
sure,
or that you kind of reminded me of, is McDonald's and Happy Meals. It's the association for a kid. It's the association of, I get a toy every time I eat this food. And so even if the food isn't that great, I'm positively associating getting that toy with the food. So the food tastes better. Plus it's got the name Happy Meal. So I'm happy when I eat this. I'm happy I get the toy. I'm happy when I eat this.
You come to associate diarrhea with fulfillment in life. And toys and things to play with.
I don't know. Maybe the diarrhea comes a little bit later, so they don't associate the diarrhea.
Oh, delayed diarrhea. Yeah, it's a delayed diarrhea schedule.
Right. So as far as when it comes to marketing, the one thing that I would warn against, first of all, is what I call clickbait copywriting. This is, for a while, it was real prevalent on social media, mm-hmm, where people would do blatant clickbait. It's still the same way now. A lot of articles, you read the headline and you're like, what? I'm outraged. And then you go and read the article and you're like, well, the fifth paragraph says the exact opposite of what the headline says.
Man, these people writing these headlines, when they actually follow it up with some crappy article, they give themselves so many escape hatches to be like, oh, it's not, I mean, yeah, I guess the headline, but you know, it says here in the article, it's just like everything is, it's not an outright negation, but it just creates all of this wiggle room that they have to like not really deliver on what they said, to not be held accountable. And you know, the headline is either an exaggeration or sometimes, just like you said, completely dishonest.
Yeah. So what that does is it causes a short-term gain, but it causes a long-term loss. For the short term, you're going to get a bunch of people clicking through. You're going to get the ad dollars for everybody that lands on your page. But in the long term, you're going to violate the trust of people. And when they see the third time that they've, from the same website, they've seen three different times where they clicked on it and the article was the exact opposite of what the headline made it look out to be.
Yeah.
The fourth time, they're not going to click. The fifth time, they're not going to click. And there's that diminishing returns. So I'm very much against clickbait copywriting. If you're trying to get people to click to your sales page, if you're trying to get people to click through from your email or from your Facebook ad, make sure that you're delivering what you're promising. Make sure that you're not violating the trust of the people. So clickbait works, but I'm very anti-clickbait when it comes to my copywriting.
You know, I've thought about this in terms of the podcast, and I wonder if I've ever lost new, potentially engageable listeners with titles, right? Mm. Because I'm pretty careful, like, the purpose of a title is to get a person to listen to the show. When you do a show that sometimes is like an hour and a half, 2 hours long, and you have a dynamic guest who can talk about a lot of things, it might be hard to give it a title that's much more than that person's name. But a person's name, you know, unless it's like a really great, I mean, there are some, like if it was like School Sucks Podcast episode 677, Alex Jones, good, that name works, people are listening, right? But in most cases, you want to find something that kind of synthesizes everything that's happening, but also is attractive to a listener. And I feel like I might have, you know, Rush for Time or whatever, created a few titles that didn't deliver, right? That didn't fully or maybe even a little misleading. Sometimes maybe intentionally misleading in a way that delivers and people go, you know what? It's okay that I was misled. but yeah, you're right. It's tricky business because if somebody, you know, thinks they're going to get something. And then it's not just like scanning through an article. It's investing half hour, 45 minutes, an hour in a podcast. I bet they'd be pissed. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been one of these idiots? Because I have, that goes through one of those, like you see it on social media and then you click into it and it wants you to go through a bunch of sequential pages because of something that it promised in the preview on when you saw it on Facebook. And it's never there. I mean, I shouldn't say never there, like I've done it more than once,
I'm giving myself credit. I've probably done it three times in my life.
The celebrity wardrobe mishaps, 12 shocking celebrity wardrobe mishaps you can't miss. And I'm like, oh, I want to see that one. And I click through all 12 and I'm like, wait, what was the one that I was looking for?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So when it comes to podcast episode names, when it comes to emails, this is a big one that I see that drives me nuts with emails is the subject line promises or makes me curious about something and then doesn't deliver. So if that's the case, I'm definitely not going to click on the link in the email because I clicked open the email and you violated my trust. I'm not going to trust you again to click on the link in your email. So yeah, making sure that if you're evoking curiosity or you're making a promise about something that someone's going to get when they click on the other side, make sure that you're delivering, you're answering the question that the curiosity evokes, or you're delivering on the promise that you made in order to get them to give you your attention in the first place. Because violating that trust, you can get away with it once or twice, but after that, people will just, they'll be trained. Another one of those subconscious trainings that doesn't even happen on a conscious level. It just, oh, the last two times I pushed this button, I was electrocuted. I'm not going to push this button anymore.
Right. Absolutely. Is that everything?
No. I got two or three more examples that I'd like to cover if we can.
So you've got a couple more examples?
Yeah, if you've got the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go for it.
Okay. So another thing is knowing the two wants in your sales copy. And what I mean by that is, what do I want the people to do when they're reading my sales copy? Do I want them to click through to the sales page? Do I want them to sign up for the free newsletter? Do I want them to buy my product? Do I want them to watch the free video? Whatever it is that I want is one of the wants. The other one is, what do they want? What is going to be their reward for pushing the button? What are they going to get? The bird food? Are they going to get the solution to the problem that's driving them insane? Are they going to get the answer to the curiosity that they can't not know what the answer is? There's always two wants in any piece of marketing. There's what the person wants, and you need to be able to deliver on that. And then there's what you want them to do. And that is what the piece of marketing, the sales copy, should be driving towards. It should be driving towards giving them what they want and then getting them to do what you want. The second to last one, we kind of already talked about this. I like to put links in all of my emails, whether it's linking to a sales page, whether it's linking to a free piece of content that will increase the value of what they originally signed up for, whether it's linking to an article, whether it's linking to a podcast episode. I like to put a link in every single one of my emails. And the reason for that is, again, just that conditioning. If they're trained to know that when they open up my email, there's going to be a link. And when they click on the link, they're going to get something special. Then when I link out to my sales page, they're already conditioned to click the links at the bottom of my emails or at the tops of my emails, wherever I put the link at. I've rewarded them 8 times. They've gotten 8 really awesome things every time that they've clicked through one of the links. The next time they open up my email and it's sending them to my sales page, they've got that behaviorism programming to where they know, hey, when I push this button, I get some bird food, or when I push this button, I get some rat food. So they push the button, they click through on the email.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you about the schedule for doing that. So it's a series like 5, 6, 7, 8. I don't know if you think there's a magic number of, you know, free value adds for a person before you would try to make them an offer.
So this goes back to the reinforcement schedules that we were talking about earlier. And it's different for every market. I've found for some markets, for like mass markets, it can be every other email. It can be one email gives them something for free. The next email sends them to the sales page. One email gives them something for free. Next email sends them to the sales page. For more, I guess, more niche down markets, it's 3 or 4 pieces of free content and then the sales page, 3 or 4 pieces of content and then the sales page. And then for other markets where they're like, hey, don't waste my time with stuff. I signed up for your newsletter because I want the solution to this. Then it's right away, sales page, sales page, sales page, sales page, free content, sales page, free content. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of depends on the different markets, and you kind of have to just play around with it and figure out what the reinforcement schedules for that particular market are.
Sure. And the free content is just like media, like podcasts, or what are you typically linking people to? Because obviously, you know, you can't create some kind of unique free giveaway every time you send an email.
So it depends. If you're a podcaster, it can be out to old episodes. Hey, I really think you'd enjoy this. Or if you're struggling with this, here's a series that we did about how to get this solution or whatever. For a lot of my sales funnels now, we just create content, and that can just be like 5-minute or 2-minute Facebook or I guess cell phone recorded videos. It's just, you signed up for my podcasting quick start guide. Here's a quick video on the best type of microphone. Here's a quick video on the best types of ways to soundproof your room. Here's a quick video on how to get listener engagement. And it can just be, they open up the email, it links to a YouTube video or a video on your website. And then the video just gives them 2 minutes of additional you talking about your expertise. And then at the bottom of that video, you can say, hey, there's a button down below this video. It sends you to a page where you get an additional thing. And that additional thing is, here's where my actual offer is. So in all of them, here's what they're wanting. They're wanting to figure out how to do a podcast. They're wanting to figure out how to get their life together. They're wanting to figure out how to lose that extra 5 pounds. You give them a little bit of free content. You give them the what and the why, and then you tell them, oh, by the way, if you really need to know how, click the additional button at the bottom of this video, and it'll send you to my sales page where I show you how to do
it. I love
this.
That. Awesome. Hey, before we wrap up, here's a fun thing that I thought we could do together. One of the podcasts that I produce, they always have this back and forth about, what do you want to do next? It's a show about, it's called Online Great Books, right? So they read books. But we have like so many interesting topics we could potentially explore here. Do you have any in mind, like on deck? Do you have a long list?
No, generally about a week before we're going to record, I'm like, well, I can either use this for the dark arts of marketing, or I can, and I usually have 2 or 3 ideas. And I say, which one is the one that Brett would probably be able to add the most to the conversation with? And so that's usually the one that I pitch to you. So I have no idea what we're going to talk about next month.
Sure. Yeah. Neither do I. I've been wanting to do one on social media. Specifically, I think that would be interesting. It's obviously, I mean, you know, is it really a hot topic still? It's been a hot topic for years, but The Social Dilemma came out a bunch of months ago. And then in my university discussion groups, we dug into that. We did a series on The Social Dilemma. And I was kind of wishing that you could have been involved in that. Because I always promote you as the Facebook world champion. I repost things that you post on Facebook with I don't say anything. Like I share your posts and just put a fucking trophy, send it out. You really have like Facebook and Facebook shit posting mastered. And you get such great engagement, and it's been really great for your business. And I think it would be a worthwhile conversation. You do have a whole mini course on it too. That I hope people who are watching us live right now have consumed. I've consumed it. I apply it sometimes and then feel kind of bad about it. And I'm working on that negotiation right now. But I think that would be a topic in like considering that you use it for such good for, you know, like attracting a following and then just rewarding those people with your posts. But this is also, and I don't mean to be an alarmist, it is also, I think, a very dangerous thing in a lot of different ways, personally, societally. You look like you might disagree, which means I think I want this to be our next topic.
Yeah, the double-edged sword of social media. I think that would be a great topic for the next episode.
Yeah, and we promise we will deliver something beyond what they talk about in The Social Dilemma, because there are problems, and you know, The Social Dilemma has agendas of its own embedded into it. So... I think there's a lot worth exploring there. If people are part of my supporting listeners, either through Patreon or the AV Club, definitely go check out the conversation that we did on The Social Dilemma. But I think having a conversation about the bigger social media picture with Nathan next month would be a great addition to this series. So maybe we'll do that. Maybe you'll come up with something better.
No, you know what? I think we should stick with that, because I think that it, when we first started talking about this series, that was one of the first things that you brought up, and we've kind of tiptoed around the subject, but I think it would make a good deep dive for an episode. So yeah, let's plan on that.
Yeah, I actually thought today's show would be a lot more about that. I thought this might, because of the way you know, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram use these positive reinforcement schedules, I thought that was going to become a big part of our conversation. I liked everything else that we managed to get in there instead, and I think it can definitely be its own show. So yeah, I'm excited to plan for that.
Let me add one more thing before we're out of here.
Sure.
This is the biggest thing that I find on clients' websites that drives me insane, and it's not understanding action colors. When you have a website, everything that's actionable should be in one color. Everything that you want people to click on should be in one color, whether it's the toolbar at the top, whether it's links, whether it's buttons. Everything should always be one color. You should pick one color, and it goes back to that behaviorism. You're training people to expect something with a particular color. You're training them to know when they see this color, hey, this is where I click. And so many people, their websites have some of the buttons are blue, some of the buttons are orange, some of the buttons are purple, some of the linkable text is red. Make sure that when you have a website, understand that that causes confusion. People don't know, you're missing out on people clicking through to the next page. And when you've rewarded people with, hey, whenever I click the orange button on this website, it takes me to something else even better. When you want them to click the buy now button, make sure that it's also orange, because they've been rewarded every time they click something that's orange. If you want the ultimate reward, it should also be something that where they click it, it's going to be orange. That's one of the biggest problems I see on amateur e-commerce websites, is not having a consistent action color. And it all, again, goes back to behaviorism. When I push this button, I get this reward. When I push this color of button, I get this kind of reward. Again, I'm not advocating for taking advantage of people, but I am advocating for understanding how people work. And in business, a lot of what it comes down to, the people that succeed are the ones that best understand how people work.
Absolutely. Well said. So I hinted at a John Taylor Gatto story. Can I just tell you that on the way out? Because this is really
interesting. Absolutely.
It's not, you know what? I shouldn't even, this is a bonus show, so I'm just going to say it, but I shouldn't even tell it as a story until it happens. I might have, I would say.
Wait.
Yeah.
Are you going to have like a medium come on the show and like bring the ghost of John Taylor Gatto?
I would be closer to being able to do that after I do what is going to be in this story.
Okay.
So I am, I think, about to accept the honorable duty of being part of a team that, wait till you hear this, goes in onto the island of Manhattan. Have you heard about this place? In December, to rescue his collection of books that he has written notes in, that he has marked pages in, that he used to write things like the Ultimate History or the Underground History of American Education. I might be part of a team that goes and retrieves this before his apartment that he lived in is sold and, you know, cleaned out, and before the entire city burns. So
wow. So real quick, I want you to actually plug those two, the one that Rich did and the one that you did, because I think that some people maybe in my audience might not be familiar with John Taylor Gatto. I think we probably just brushed over him really quickly in the beginning of the episode and didn't explain exactly who he was and what kind of impact he had on the kind of an educational rebellion as far as the way the education system in America works.
Sure. So John Taylor Gatto was, I think he was New York State Teacher of the Year a couple of times in his career. And he took a quite rebellious approach to teaching middle school, where he offered kids lots of autonomy to go out into the city. And this was in a different world. You know, this is, we're talking 70s and 80s, to go out into the world and, you know, make their own meaning and do their own learning and pursue their own passions. You know, this sounds like so far-fetched today, but he would like pair up kids with like a truck driver and like go do this stuff with this truck driver today. And he would show people that, you know, through hard, like real world, meaningful work, they could, you know, accomplish things and build self-esteem that way, that school was never going to deliver. And he knew it. I mean, that, I think that's why that was his teaching style. There's a really, I don't want to throw too much stuff at people, but if you want to take it, like maybe you're a teacher, or you have children, there is a good documentary that, that kind of goes from like the actual work that he did, and it's called Classrooms of the Heart. You can definitely find a VHS to YouTube conversion of it somewhere. It's probably from the late 80s, I would say. It shows Gatto in his classroom and shows him working with students, and then there's interviews of him as well. And I think that was once he started to get some attention for maybe some of his criticisms as a New York State Teacher of the Year. So it could be early 90s too. I often describe my work at schoolsucksproject.com as a kind of on-ramp to Richard Grove's work, which are these, just in the case of like a lot of his films and his podcasts that sometimes are like 15 hours long. His podcast is called Peace Revolution. Those are big undertakings. And he... you know, is really trying to build audiences with attention spans. Well, most of my show, or, you know, not even necessarily, like it's, you don't have to listen to something 15 hours at once, but he wants to do deep dives on these subjects. He's actually moved on to other projects now, but the Peace Revolution podcast is still there. And I saw a lot of the work. He was actually the first podcast I ever listened to. He did a show called 9/11 Synchronicity. So I saw his work as incredibly valuable. When we started working together, I said, you know, I think a lot of the stuff that I do would lead people to the things that you do. I mean, I'm sure it works both ways, but I'm offering kind of like, you know, easy to digest introductions to some of these deeper explorations that you're doing. So he made this film about Gatto where he went and he put Gatto in his living room for an entire weekend and interviewed him. And the whole film is, it's long. It's over 5 hours long. You can find it on YouTube in its entirety. But if you want it like a preview of, you know, Gatto's incisiveness and where he's coming from and a bit of his philosophy, I, to again, try to promote Rich's bigger, you know, more involved work, made a series of mostly short YouTube videos. Most of them are like 3 to 7 minutes, I would say, is the range that most of them are in. I think there's 15 in the series. And it's on my YouTube channel, which is School Sucks Podcast. And it's just called, it's the playlist right at the top. It's called The Underground History of American Education. And it just takes excerpts from that book and it tries to make them as much like movie trailers as possible. So if people are intrigued by that, I hope they will go and watch The Ultimate History Lesson, which is like a real, you know, deep dive into the history of the schooling system, which is really important and really unknown. And Gatto, it's unfortunate, has been a totally ignored person just because there's no way to deal with him from like a criticism standpoint. So they just act like he doesn't exist, or he never existed. He died a couple of years ago. But yeah, I would. That is one of the most overlooked negative forces in our entire society. So I really hope that through my work or elsewhere, people will learn more about the history of school, about the politics of school, especially if you have children in the school. And like we talked about today, the psychology, if you want to call it that, that operates the schools, which is primarily behaviorism, but there's lots of other problems there as well. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to put in a very long plug.
Yeah, absolutely. So real quick, my plug is, if you want to check out more of my work, I do a podcast called The Dark Arts of Marketing, and you can subscribe to that. It's much briefer episodes than this one was. And Brett, you do the School Sucks Project. Mm-hmm. And what's the website for that?
SchoolSucksProject.com.
Awesome.
Wait, give the Dark Arts of Marketing website.
Oh, you can find that at thedampodcast.com. That's THEDAM podcast.com.
That's the only thing you want to plug?
That's the only thing I'll plug right now.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks again. I look forward to doing another one next month.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brett. And I will holler at you later, man.